He wished he could believe that Rose would be the only one there tomorrow who would recognize him, but if wishes were pigs, bacon would always be on sale. He had to assume they would be looking for him, and he would also have to assume they had received pictures of him from one of their sister groups back home. He didn't know about the X, but he was coming to believe that the first two letters in FAC stood for fucked again. That was one part of the problem. The other part was his own belief, backstopped by more than one bitter experience, that disguises were a recipe for disaster in situations like this. The only quicker, surer route to failure in the field was probably wearing the ever-popular wire, where you can lose 6 months' worth of surveillance and setup if a kid happened to be running a radio-controlled boat or race car in the area where you were planning to bring the hammer down on some shitbag. All right, he thought. Don't bitch about it. Remember what old Whitey Slater used to say, the situation is what the situation is. How you're going to work around it is the only question. And don't even think of putting it off. Their goddamn party is just 24 hours away, and if you miss her there, you could hunt for her until Christmas and not find her. In case you hadn't noticed, this is a big city. He got up, walked into the bathroom, and showered with his blistered hands stuck out through the shower curtain. He dressed in faded jeans and a nondescript green shirt, putting on his Chi Sox cap and tucking the cheap sunglasses into his shirt pocket, at least for the time being. He took the elevator down to the lobby and went to the newsstand to get a paper and a box of Band-Aids. While he was waiting for the dope behind the counter to figure out his change, he looked over the guy's shoulder and through a glass panel at the back of the newsstand alcove. He could see the service elevators through this panel, and as he watched, one of them opened. Three chattering, laughing chambermaids stepped out. They were carrying their purses, and Norman guessed they were on their way to lunch. He had seen the one in the middle, slim, pretty, fluffy blonde hair, someplace else. After a moment, it came to him. He had been on his way to check out daughters and sisters. The blonde had walked beside him for a little while. Red slacks, cute little ass. "Here you are, sir," the counterman said. Norman stuffed his change into his pocket without looking at it. Nor did he look at the trio of maids as he shouldered past them, not even at the one with the cute tush. He had cross-referenced her automatically, that was all. It was a cop reflex, a knee that jerked on its own. His conscious mind was fixed on one thing and one thing only, the best way to spot Rose tomorrow without being spotted himself. He was heading up the corridor toward the doors when he heard two words which he at first thought must have come out of his own head, Edinger's Pier. His stride faltered, his heart kicked into overdrive, and the blister in the palm of his hand began to throb fiercely. It was a single misstep, that was all, that one little hesitation, and then he went on heading toward the revolving doors with his head down. Someone looking at him might have thought he'd felt a brief muscle twinge in his knee or calf, no more than that, and that was good. He didn't dare falter. That was the hell of it. If the woman who'd spoken was one of the cunts from their clubhouse over on Durham Avenue, she might recognize him if he drew attention to himself, might have already recognized him, if the speaker of those two magic words was the little honey he'd crossed the street beside the other day. He knew it was unlikely. As a cop, he'd had first-hand experience of how amazingly, numbingly unobservant most civilians were. But from time to time, it did happen. Killers and kidnappers and bank thieves, who had eluded capture long enough to make the FBI's 10 most wanted list, suddenly found themselves back in the slam, dropped by a 7-Eleven clerk who read True Detective, or a meter maid who watched all the reality crime shows on TV. He didn't dare stop, but he had to stop. Norman knelt abruptly to the left of the swinging door with his back to the women. He dropped his head and pretended to tie his shoe. "Sorry to miss the concert, but if I want that car, I can't pass up the..." Out the door they went, but what Norman had heard convinced him. It was the picnic the woman was talking about, the picnic and the concert that was going to round off the day, some group called the Indian Girls, probably Lezzies. So there was a chance that this woman knew Rosie. Not a good chance. Lots of people who weren't tight with daughters and sisters would be at Edinger's Pier tomorrow, but a chance just the same. And Norman was a man who believed emphatically in the fickle finger of fate. The hell of it was, he did not yet know which of the three had been talking. "Let it be Blondie," he prayed as he got quickly to his feet and went out through the swinging door. "Let it be Blondie with the big eyes and the cute ass. Let it be her, what do you say?" It was dangerous to follow, of course. You could never tell when one of them might glance idly around and win the super bonus round of place the face. But at this point, he could do nothing else. He sauntered along behind them, his head casually turned to one side as if the junkola in the shop windows he was passing was of vital interest to him. "How are you making out on pillowcases today?" the tub of guts walking on the inside asked the other two. "For once they're all there," the older woman walking on the outside said. "How about you, Pam?" "I haven't counted yet. It's too depressing," Blondie replied, and they all laughed, those high, giggly sounds that always made Norman feel as if his fillings were cracking in his mouth. He stopped at once, looking in a window at a bunch of sporting goods, letting the maids pull ahead. It was her, all right, no question about it. Blondie was the one who had said the magic words, Ettinger's Pier. Maybe it changed everything, maybe it changed nothing. Right now, he was too excited to figure it out. It was certainly an amazing stroke of luck, though, the kind of miraculous, coincidental break you always hoped for when you were working a long-shot case, the break that happened more often than anyone would ever believe. For now, he would file this in the back of his mind and proceed with Plan A. He wouldn't even ask about Blondie back at the hotel, at least not yet. He knew her name was Pam, and that was plenty to start with. Norman walked to the bus stop, waited 15 minutes for the airport shuttle, and then hopped on board. It was a long ride. The terminal was on the edge of the city. When he finally disembarked in front of Terminal A, he slipped on his dark glasses, crossed the street, and made his way to the long-term parking area. The first car he tried jumping had been there so long the battery was dead. The second one, a nondescript Ford Tempo, started all right. He told the man in the collection booth that he had been in Dallas for 3 weeks and had lost his ticket. He was always losing them, he said. He lost laundry tickets, too, and he was always having to show his driver's license at Photomat when he stopped in to pick up his snapshots. The man in the collection booth nodded and nodded the way you do at a boring story you've already heard about 10,000 times. When Norman humbly offered him an extra $10 in lieu of the ticket, the man in the collection booth perked up a little. The money disappeared. Norman Daniels drove out of long-term parking at almost exactly the same moment that Robbie Lefferts was offering his fugitive wife what he termed a more solid business arrangement. 2 miles down the road, Norman parked behind a beat-to-shit LeSabre and swapped license plates. Another 2 miles on, he stopped at a robo-wash. He had a bet with himself that the Tempo would turn out to be dark blue, but he lost. It was green. He didn't think it mattered. The man in the collection booth had only taken his eyes off his little black-and-white TV when the 10-spot had appeared under his nose, but it was best to play safe. It increased the comfort level. Norman turned on the radio and found an oldie station. Shirley Ellis was on, and he sang along as Shirley instructed, "If the first two letters are ever the same, drop them both and say the name like Barry, Barry, drop the B-O-Ary. That's the only rule that is contrary." Norman realized he knew every word of that stupid old song. What kind of world was it, where you couldn't remember the fucking quadratic equation or the various forms of the French verb avoir 2 years after you got out of high school, but when you were getting on for 40 years old, you could still remember nick-nick bobic, banana-fana-fofic, fee-fi-momic, nick? What kind of world was that? "One that's slipping behind me now," Norman thought serenely, and yes, that seemed to be the truth. It was like in those science fiction movies where the spacemen saw Earth dwindling in the view screens. First a ball, then a coin, then a tiny glowing dot, then all gone. That was what the inside of his head was like now, a spacecraft headed out on a 5-year mission to explore new worlds and go where no man had gone before. The starship Norman, approaching warp speed. Shirley Ellis finished up and something by the Beatles came on. Norman twisted the radio's volume knob off so hard he broke it. He didn't want to listen to any of that hippy-dippy Hey Jude crap today. He was still a couple of miles from where the real city began when he saw a place called the Base Camp. "Army surplus like you never find," the sign out front read, and for some reason that made him burst out laughing. He thought it was in some ways the single most peculiar motto he'd seen in his whole life. It seemed to mean something, but it was impossible to say just what. Anyway, the sign didn't matter. The store probably had one of the things he was looking for, and that did. There was a big banner reading, "Always be safe, never be sorry," over the middle aisle. Norman inspected three different kinds of stun gas, pepper gas pellets, a rack of ninja throwing stars, the perfect weapon for home defense if you should happen to be attacked by a blind quadriplegic, gas guns that fired rubber bullets, slingshots, brass knuckles, both plain and studded, blackjacks and bolas, whips and whistles. Halfway down this aisle was a glass case containing what Norman considered to be the only really useful item in the base camp. For $63.50, he purchased a taser, which produced a large, although probably not the 90,000 volts promised on the label, wallop of juice between its two steel poles when the triggers were pushed. Norman considered this weapon every bit as dangerous as a small caliber pistol, and the best part was that one did not have to sign one's name anywhere in order to purchase one. "You want a 9-volt battery with that?" the clerk asked. He was a bullet-headed young man with a hare lip. He wore a T-shirt which said, "Better to have a gun and not need one than need one and not have one." To Norman, he looked like the sort of fellow whose parents might have been blood relatives.
"That's what it runs on, a 9-volt."
Norman realized what the young man with the hare lip was trying to say and nodded. "Give me two," he said. "Let's live a little." The young man laughed as if this was the funniest line he'd ever heard, even funnier than army surplus like you never find. And then he bent down, got 2 9-volt batteries from under the counter, and slapped them down beside Norman's Amiga taser.
"Don't feature!"
the young man cried, and laughed some more. Norman figured this one out, too, after a moment, and laughed right along with young Mr. Hairlip, and later he thought that was the exact moment when he hit warp speed and all the stars turned into lines. "All ahead, Mr. Sulu. This time we're going way past the Klingon Empire." He drove the stolen Tempo back into the city, and in a part of town where the smiling models on the cigarette billboard started being black rather than white, he found a barber shop by the charming name of Cut Me Some Slack. He went in and found a young black man with a cool mustache sitting in an old-fashioned barber chair. There were Walkman earphones on his head and a copy of Jet in his lap.
"What you want?"
the black barber asked. He spoke perhaps more brusquely than he would have to a black man, but not discourteously either. You weren't discourteous to a man like this without a damn good reason, especially when you were alone in your shop. He was 6'2" at least, with broad shoulders and big, thick legs. Also, he smelled like a cop. Above the mirror were photographs of Michael Jordan, Charles Barkley, and Jalen Rose. Jordan was wearing a Birmingham Barons baseball uniform. Above his picture was a slip of paper with "The Once and Future Bull" typed on it. Norman pointed. "Do me like that," he said. The black barber looked at Norman carefully, first making sure he wasn't drunk or stoned, then trying to make sure he wasn't joking. The second was harder than the first.
"What you saying, brother? Are you saying you want a clean head?"
"That's exactly what I'm saying." Norman ran a hand through his hair, which was a thick black, just starting to show flecks of gray at the temples. It was neither exceptionally short nor exceptionally long. He had worn it at this same length for almost 20 years. He looked at himself in the mirror, trying to imagine what he was going to look like, as bald as Michael Jordan, only white. He couldn't do it. With luck, Rose and her new friends wouldn't be able to either.
"You sure?"
Suddenly, Norman felt almost sick with the desire to knock this man down and drop both knees onto his chest and lean over and bite his entire upper lip, cool mustache and all, right off his face. He supposed he knew why, too. He looked like that memorable little cocksucker Ramon Sanders, the one who had tried to cash in on the ATM card his lying bitch of a wife had stolen. "Oh, barber," Norman thought. "Oh, barber. You're so close to being nothing but taillights. Ask one more question. Say one more wrong word in my face, and that's all you'll be. And I can't say anything to you. I couldn't warn you, even if I wanted to, because right now, my own voice is all the firing pin I'd need. So here we are, and here we go." The barber gave him another long, careful look. Norman stood where he was and let him do it. Now he felt composed. What happened would be what happened. It was all in this jiggity-jig's hands.
"All right, I guess you are," the barber said at last.
His voice was mild and disarming. Norman relaxed his right hand, which had been shoved deep into his pocket and gripping the handle of the taser. The barber put his magazine on the counter beside his bottles of tonic and cologne. there was a little brass sign there that said Samuel Lowe, then got up and shook out a plastic apron. You won't be like Mike? Let's do it. 20 minutes later, Norman was staring at himself thoughtfully in the mirror. Samuel Lowe stood beside his chair, watching him look. Lowe seemed apprehensive, but he also seemed interested. He looked like a man seeing something familiar from an entirely new perspective. Two new customers had come in. They were also looking at Norman look at himself, and they wore identical expressions of appraisal.
The man be handsome, one of the newcomers said. He spoke in a tone of faint surprise, and mostly to himself.
Norman couldn't get entirely straight in his mind the fact that the man in the mirror was still him. He winked and the mirror man winked. He smiled and the mirror man smiled. He turned and the mirror man turned, but it didn't help. Before, he'd had the brow of a cop. Now he had the brow of a mathematics professor, a brow that went into the stratosphere. He couldn't get over the smooth, somehow sensuous curves of his bald skull and its whiteness. He hadn't thought he had anything like a tan, but compared to his pallid skull, the rest of his skin was as brown as a lifeguard's. His head looked strangely fragile and too weirdly perfect to belong to the likes of him, to belong to any human being, especially a male. It looked like a piece of Delft china.
You ain't got a bad head tall, man, Lowe said.
He spoke tentatively, but Norman had no sense he was trying to flatter him, and that was good, because Norman was in no mood to have someone blow smoke up his ass.
Look good. Look younger, don't he, Dale? Ain't bad, the other newcomer agreed. No, sir, not half.
How much did you say? Norman asked Samuel Lowe. He tried to turn away from the mirror and was distressed and a little frightened to find that his eyes tried to follow the top of his head to see how it looked in the back. That sense of disassociation was stronger within him than ever. He wasn't the man in the mirror, the man with a scholar's bald head rising above heavy black eyebrows. How could he be? This was some stranger, that was all, some fantastic Lex Luthor up to no good in Metropolis. And the things he did from here on out didn't matter. From here on out, nothing mattered, except catching Rose, of course, and talking to her, up close. Lowe was giving him that cautious look again, breaking it off to dart glances at the other two patrons, and Norman suddenly realized he was checking to see if they'd help him if the big white man, the big bald white man, suddenly went berserk. I'm sorry, he said, trying to make his voice soft and conciliatory. You were talking, weren't you? What did you say?
I said, 30 sounds about right to me. How's it sound to you?
Norman took a folded-over packet of bills out of his left front pocket, slid 2 20s out from under the tarnished old money clip, and held them out. 30 sounds too low, he said. Take 40, along with my apologies. You did a great job. I've just had a bitch of a week, that's all.
You don't know the half of it, buddy, he thought.
Samuel Lowe relaxed visibly and took the money.
No prob, bro, he said. And I wasn't kidding. You ain't got a bad-looking head at all. You ain't Michael, but ain't nobody Michael.
Except Michael, the newcomer named Dale said. The three black men laughed heartily and nodded at one another. Although he could have killed all three of them without turning a hair, Norman nodded and laughed along with them. The newcomers in the barber shop had changed things. It was time to be careful again. Still laughing, he went out. A trio of teenagers, also black, were leaning against a fence near the Tempo, but they hadn't bothered doing anything to the car, possibly because it was too much of a dog to bother with. They eyed Norman's pallid white head with interest, then glanced at each other and rolled their eyes. They were 14 or so, boys without much trouble in them. The one in the middle started to say, "You looking at me?" like Robert De Niro in Taxi Driver. Norman seemed to sense this and stared at him, just at him, it seemed, ignoring the other two completely. The one in the middle decided that maybe his De Niro imitation needed a little more work and quit it. Norman got into his freshly washed stolen car and drove away. 6 blocks in toward the center of the city, he went into a used clothing store called Play It Again, Sam. There were several browsers in the store, and they all looked at him, but that was okay. Norman didn't mind being looked at, especially if it was his freshly shaven skull they were paying attention to. If they were looking at the top of his head, they wouldn't have the slightest fucking idea what his face looked like 5 minutes after he left. He found a motorcycle jacket that gleamed with studs and zippers and small silver chains and creaked in every fold when he took it off its hanger. The clerk opened his mouth to ask $240 for the jacket, looked at the haunted eyes peering out from beneath the awesome white desert of that freshly shaven skull, and told Norman the jacket was $180 plus tax. He would have gone lower had Norman dickered, but Norman didn't. He was tired now, his head was throbbing, and he wanted to go back to the hotel and go to sleep. He wanted to sleep right through until tomorrow. He needed all the rest he could get, because tomorrow was going to be a busy day. He made two more stops on the way back. The first was at a store which sold ostomy supplies. Here Norman bought a motorless second-hand wheelchair which would fit, folded up, into the trunk of the Tempo. Then he went to the Women's Cultural Center and Museum. Here he paid $6 to get in, but looked at no exhibits and did not so much as peer into the auditorium, where a panel discussion on natural childbirth was being held. He made a quick trip to the gift shop, then left. Back at the Whitestone, he went upstairs without asking anyone about Blondie with a cute little ass. He would not have trusted himself to ask for a glass of club soda in his current condition. His newly shaven head was pounding like a steel forge. His eyes were beating in their sockets. His teeth hurt and his jaws throbbed. Worst of all, his mind now seemed to be bobbing along above him like a float in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade. It felt as if it were tethered to the rest of him by a single fragile thread and might break away at any moment. He had to lie down, to sleep. Maybe then his mind would go back inside his head where it belonged. As for Blondie, his best course would be to treat her as an ace in the hole, something to be used only if absolutely necessary, break glass in case of emergency. Norman went back to bed at 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon. The throbbing behind his temples was no longer anything resembling a hangover. It was now one of the headaches he called his specials. He got them frequently when he was working hard, and since Rose had left and his big drug case had heated up, two a week weren't unusual. As he lay in bed, looking up at the ceiling, his eyes ran and his nose leaked, and he could see funny, bright zigzag patterns pulsing around the edges of things. The pain had reached the point where it felt like there was some horrible fetus in the middle of his head trying to be born, the point where there was nothing to do but hunker down and wait for it to be over. And the way you did that was by getting through the moments one at a time, going from one to the next, the way a person might use stepping stones to cross a stream. That tugged some hazy memory far back in his mind, but it couldn't get past the relentless throbbing, and Norman let it go. He rubbed his hand back and forth across the top of his head. The smoothness up there felt like nothing that could be a part of him. It was like touching the hood of a freshly waxed car. "Who am I?" he asked the empty room. "Who am I? Why am I here? What am I doing? Who am I?" Before he could stab at an answer to any of these questions, he fell asleep. The pain followed him for quite a distance into its dreamless depths, like a bad idea that won't let go. But finally Norman left it behind. His head sagged to one side on his pillow, and a wetness which was not precisely tears ran out of his left eye and left nostril and trickled down his cheek. He began to snore thickly. When he woke up 12 hours later at 4 o'clock on Saturday morning, his headache was gone. He felt fresh and energized, as he almost always did after one of his specials. He sat up, put his feet on the floor, and looked out the window at darkness. The pigeons were out there on the ledge, cooing to each other even in their sleep. He knew, completely and surely and without any doubt, that this day was going to see the end of it. Probably the end of him as well, but that was a minor matter. Just knowing there would be no more headaches, not ever, made that seem like a fair trade. Across the room, his new motorcycle jacket hung over a chair like a black and headless ghost. "Wake up early, Rose," he thought, almost tenderly. "Wake up early, honey bunch, and get a good look at the sunrise, why don't you? You ought to get the best look you can, because it's the last one you're ever going to see."
Rosie woke at a few minutes past 4 on Saturday morning and fumbled for the lamp by the bed, terrified, sure that Norman was in the room with her, sure she could smell his cologne. All my men wear English leather, or they wear nothing at all. She almost knocked the lamp onto the floor in her panicky efforts to make a light, but when it was finally on, with the base hanging halfway over oblivion, her fear subsided quickly. It was just her room, small and neat and sane, and the only thing she could smell was the faint bedwarm fragrance of her own skin. No one was here but her, and Rose Madder, of course. But Rose Madder was safely put away in the closet, where she undoubtedly still stood with one hand raised to shade her eyes, looking down at the ruins of the temple. I was dreaming about him, she thought as she sat up. I was having another nightmare about Norman, that's why I woke up so scared. She pushed the lamp back on the table. It clinked against the armlet. Rose picked it up and looked at it. Strange how hard it was to remember what you have to remember, how she'd come by this trinket. Had she bought it in Bill's shop, because it looked like the one the woman in her picture was wearing? She didn't know, and that was troubling. How could you forget what you need to forget, a thing like that? Rosie lifted the circlet, which felt as heavy as gold but was probably just gilded pot metal, and looked across the room through it, like a woman looking through a telescope. As she did, a fragment of her dream came back, and she realized it hadn't been about Norman at all. It had been about Bill. They had been on his motorcycle, but instead of taking her to a picnic place by the lake, he had driven her down a path that wound deeper and deeper into a sinister forest of dead leaves. After a while, they came into a clearing, and in the clearing was a single live tree, laden with fruit the color of Rose Madder's chiton. Oh, what a great first course, Bill had cried cheerfully, hopping off his motorcycle and hurrying toward the tree. I've heard about these. Eat one, and you can see out of the back of your head. Eat two, and you live forever. That was where the dream had crossed the line from the merely unsettling into real nightmare country. She knew somehow that the fruit of that tree wasn't magic, but horribly poisonous, and she ran to him, wanting to stop him before he could bite into one of the tempting fruits. But Bill wouldn't be convinced. He merely put an arm around her, gave her a little hug, and said, "Don't be silly, Rosie. I know pomegranates, and these aren't them." That was when she'd awakened, shivering madly in the dark and thinking not about Bill, but about Norman. As if Norman were lying in bed someplace near and thinking about her. This idea made Rosie cross her arms over her breasts and hug herself. It was all too possible that he was doing just that. She put the armlet back down on the table, hurried into the bathroom, and turned on the shower. Her troubling dream of Bill and the poisoned fruit, her questions about where or how she might have come by the armlet, and her confused feelings about the picture she'd bought, then unframed, then hidden away in the closet like a secret. All these things faded behind a larger and more immediate concern, her date. It was today, and every time she thought of that, she felt something like a hot wire in her chest. She was both afraid and happy, but more than anything else, she was curious. Her date. Their date. If he even comes, a voice inside whispered ominously. It could have all been a joke, you know, or you might have scared him off. Rosie started to step into the water and realized just in the nick of time that she was still wearing her panties. He'll come, she murmured as she bent and slipped them off. He'll come all right. I know he will. As she ducked under the spray and reached for the shampoo, a voice far back in her mind, a very different voice this time, whispered, "Beasts will fight." What? Rosie froze with the plastic bottle in one hand. She was frightened, and she didn't quite know why. What did you say? Nothing. She couldn't even remember exactly what it was that she'd thought, only that it was something else about that damned picture, which had gotten into her head like the chorus of a song you can't forget. As she began to lather her hair, Rosie decided abruptly to get rid of it. The thought of doing that made her feel better, like the thought of quitting some bad habit, smoking, drinking at lunch. And by the time she stepped out of the shower, she was humming.